From pop culture to politics, this is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day to look at one of those great elements of the left and its agenda and of its priorities that I believe is going to damage the Democratic Party if that left-wing obsession completely takes over in Democratic circles. I'm talking about the obsession with race and gender and enumerating people, not based on who they are, not based on the content of their character, but based on the color of their skin and the way that they express their gender. Because, of course, heaven forbid that there should be any lack of diversity in any setting at all. And part of this is with this new attack, and I think it's a relatively new attack on President Trump for maintaining primarily white male national security advisors. Now, of course, they leave out Gina Haspel because she didn't appear in some of the pictures. Who's Gina Haspel? She's head of the CIA. She is certainly one of the most important people in the American security apparatus. She is also cisgendered female. What that means is she's always been female. She didn't just discover it for the sake of diversity. And the idea that President Trump is somehow lacking in this, I was thinking about it because Kate Brennan, a piece in USA Today, has this long piece just about how horrific it is that President Trump has white male advisors. Does it really make sense? What is it about a more diverse group of advisors or national security advisors or generals or admirals or any sorts of presidential assistants? Why does it matter profoundly that you should have a better representation of what are called people of color? And when I say what are called people of color, this insanity about seeing racism and race everywhere and in everything has also spread from the United States over to across the pond in Old Blighty, in Great Britain and the United Kingdom. Because this is just unbelievable. There's a headline at CNN, and this is exactly what I mean. Headline says, coming or going, Meghan, meaning the Duchess of Sussex, Meghan Markle, who is married to the grandson of Queen Elizabeth, Harry. Coming or going, Meghan gets the blame, and it's because of her race. An analysis by Lisa Respers France. From the moment Prince Harry and Meghan Markle made their relationship known to the public in 2016, the message many Britons sent her was clear. You aren't one of us and you aren't welcome. Well, she's an American, for goodness sake. And it's not that she's, I mean, that's part of it, could be. But honestly, being only very vaguely aware of Meghan Markle because she was a TV star. She is one of those TV stars like Jennifer Beal. Jennifer Beal is also mixed race. If Jennifer Beal, who I guess became famous from Flashdance years and years ago, she's also on the L Word on TV. If Jennifer Beal did not choose to identify as mixed race, and she didn't beginning early in her career, no one would know that her father was black. In Meghan Markle's case, it's that her mother is black. But seriously, if you look at the pictures and then you hear the cries about racism, it is so ludicrous and so bizarre. And now that Meghan Markle and her husband are announcing their intention, now apparently with the Queen's acquiescence and support, to move over to North America, there's all kinds of pontificating on British TV, a lot of it by someone who is a, quote, political commentator and public intellectual, Dr. Shola Mose Shagbamimu. That's her name. Dr. Shola Mose Shagbamimo. And she was actually on This Morning on ITV. And she was asked about where's the evidence of all the racist abuse that supposedly Meghan Markle has suffered. And she responded this way. Listen.
At the heart of this, Dr. Sherlock, do you believe that racism is to play? I mean, this is a question that you feel actually you're exhausted of having to defend it because for you, it's so blatant that yes, the answer is yes, racism is to play.
You've taken the words right out of my mouth. It is exhausting when you keep hearing people either deny that racism is at the heart of this. Mm-hmm. People go, it's criticism, but it's criticism steeped in racism. And look, I think the difficulty here for a lot of people is that they do not understand this thing. And the thing is that it is not the job of black people and ethnic minorities to educate white people on racism that is perpetrated by white people.
Right.
White folks need to go educate themselves on racism they perpetrate. Mm-hmm. The reason why the racism experienced by Meghan feels so personal and it deeply resonates with a lot of people is because it's symptomatic of the culture of racism in the United Kingdom.
What examples do you have?
You see, that is another problem. When people keep asking what examples, it makes me question, where have you been the last 2 years? What have you been reading? What have you been listening to?
I've been reading some criticism.
Right.
I haven't personally read anything that I could say was based on racism.
And this is part of the problem. And let me explain what racism looks like from the lens of white privilege. White privilege whitewashes racist and inflammatory language as unconscious bias. It perpetuates the bigotry of intolerant white people as ignorant. It defends and protects their private views, once spoken, as misspeak, and then camouflages racist behavior as error of judgment, which is exemplified by Danny Baker's tweet when he compared Archie to a chimpanzee. Now, look, I think... If you look at a lot of the criticisms she's faced, even a lot of the examples, it sums up to one thing. How dare she? She doesn't know her place. She's uppity, right? When a black woman, right, goes along with the flow, does what is expected of her, it's all okay. But the moment she exercises independent thought, independent authenticity, her own independent views, she's a problem.
Okay, this is, by the way, what she was referring to. You may remember it cost a guy his career, and it was truly appalling, is when they had their baby, Meghan and Harry. He took a photograph of a chimpanzee dressed up in a suit and tie saying, this is Meghan and Harry leaving the hospital with their new baby. Now, the guy who did that, who posted it, was fired from everything. His life was ruined. And again, there's no excuse for it. It was a horrible thing. But that's the one incident she could come up with when she was asked, what are the examples of racism? It seems to me, when you are claiming a status of victimhood for somebody in one of the most glamorous marriages of the recent past, who was a successful star on American television, who is now part of an extraordinarily wealthy and extraordinarily privileged family, who is a queen of fashion, who, by the way, has mostly gotten adoring press. I really don't know what this is about. The claims of victimhood, is she suffering because she's an uppity black woman? I mean, really? Really? Meghan Markle? There's more. The same expert on racism. And by the way, I looked it up. Right now, the black population in Great Britain is a little bit under 3% of the population. And 87% of Britons throughout the United Kingdom identify themselves as white. And by the way, almost 60% identify themselves as Christian. That's as opposed to about 30% who identify themselves as irreligious or not religiously affiliated. In any event, Piers Morgan, remember him? He used to be on CNN. He's a very good interviewer because he doesn't take any guff. He doesn't let people just ramble on. He confronted Dr. Shola Mose Shagbamimu in a a fairly spirited debate about the, quote, mistreatment and racist persecution to which Meghan Markle was allegedly subjected. Listen.
Where is this racism that you keep talking about? Where are the ghastly tabloids that you say have been driving this racist agenda against a woman who, as far as I was aware, because I read all the papers, lauded and welcomed her for the first 18 months as a breath of fresh air, bringing a multiracial aspect finally to a all-white royal family. Where is this racism?
Okay, so first of all, if you had paid attention to the interviews I had done, then you would have the answer, because that's an incredibly...
You keep saying, where have you been the last 2 years?
Because it's an incredibly obtuse question to keep asking. The bottom line is...
No, actually, it's a very important question.
No, actually, I'm going to flip the question.
Yeah, where is the racism?
I'm going to flip the script on this. Mm. We need to stop. I'm going to stop, especially with you.
Sure.
You are a man privileged to have power and influence, and you're using your platform so irresponsibly to spout out such personal vendetta...
So you're allowed to say...
...with nasty and vile comments.
So you're allowed to, allowed to be nasty and vile. You're allowed to say it's all racism. You're allowed to call people like me racist.
Bigotry, misogyny, sexism.
Really? Bigotry, misogyny? This entire nuttiness. And Cory Booker, who I think... I feel for him. He ran a spirited presidential campaign. He can be a good speaker. He is a bright guy. I think he means well for his country. But Cory Booker was on CBS this morning, and he was talking as if he's talking about some kind of endangered species, about how tragic it was that the Democratic Party had lost most of their minority candidates. They weren't going to be on the debate stage tonight. I mean, all except for the Native American Elizabeth Warren. Here is Senator Booker on CBS this morning.
Are you concerned this debate stage now is all white?
I'm very concerned. I still remember the reaction when Kamala Harris dropped off the stage amongst black women in my life. It was almost like, wait a minute. Here's a woman that won in California twice, who has been extraordinary, and she couldn't even get to Iowa. How could we have a situation that is creating that kind of dynamic? We have got to find a way as a party, as a nation, both parties, to understand that we are a diverse nation. I got to the United States Senate, was stunned when I first got there about how little diversity there was on Senate staff. So thank God Schumer worked with me and Brian Schatz to change a lot of that. We are a better nation when we bring hidden figures together with white male astronauts. That's how we defy gravity and go to the moon. Mm-hmm. And the Democratic Party, which represents the true rainbow coalitions of America, has got to do a better job of getting more candidates running at all levels, supporting a system that doesn't benefit big money, but really big values.
Okay, when he talks about Hidden Figures, which was a wonderful movie of a couple of years ago, he's talking about a true story where a number of black women were chosen not because they were black. They didn't say, oh, we need more diversity in NASA. There was very little diversity in NASA at the time. Very little. And the women were chosen because they were incredibly good at what they did, which is the reason you want to choose people for stuff that matters in the space program. The whole idea that what does Senator Booker expect? That we're going to set up, okay, well, here we have a lot of candidates, so we've got to guarantee that there are at least two people of color up there on the stage. There were earlier in the campaign, and they just didn't do that well. They chose these people up there. It wasn't a bunch of white power brokers sitting around in a room somewhere. It was basically laid out by the Latino, yes, that's right, by the Hispanic chair of the Democratic National Committee, Tom Perez. He laid out a basis for which someone qualified for the debates. It was based on how many donors you had and how you were faring in various polls. And sorry, Senator Booker didn't qualify for the debates this time. He didn't qualify last time. Senator Harris ran out of money. She's still a United States senator. What are they supposed to do? Say, well, we can't have this. We have to change the rules to make sure that we have some people of color up here. The entire thing is truly, it's bizarre. It's bizarre. And when you talk about this lady complaining and that shows a lot of pictures of President Trump surrounded by his Secretary of State and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Army Chief of Staff and the Marine Chief of Staff, and they're all white men. I mean, horrors. Again, if you look at that famous photograph, and it's worth looking at, of the Situation Room in the White House under President Obama, the night that they got Osama bin Laden, one of the great triumphs of the Obama presidency. There are two people who are non-white males in the room, but only two. One is the president of the United States, Barack Obama, and the other is the Secretary of State at the time, Hillary Clinton. Was it a tragedy when Hillary Clinton was reported by a white male? Not just a white male, but a white preppy Yale-y male named John Kerry. John Kerry! I mean, come on, you don't judge people that way, do you? Does it make sense? Joy Reid, who is a person of color, and I've enjoyed talking to her when I've had the chance to speak to her. She's has a weekend show on MSNBC, and she was basically playing the Nazi card to talk about what she sees as the current problem of extreme racism. Listen.
He produces a kind of anxiety in
Trump,
people
she's saying,
that is so profound. It's part of the reason people are obsessively watching this show and Rachel Maddow. And it's like Rachel Maddow is sort of their psychologist at this point, because people are afraid of not just what he can do, but what he's doing to people, what he's bringing out in people, the kind of people he's surfacing in the United States. You have swatting happening and Nazis walking around. It is a scary time.
Swatting happening? Jeremy, do you know what that's a reference to? The swatting happening and Nazis walking around? Look, it's a problem whenever you have Nazis walking around anywhere. I agree. But the idea that there has been a surge in Nazism that has been encouraged by President Trump. And by the way, isn't it ironic? Joy Behar on The View, where Abby Huntsman, by the way, is leaving The View, one of the two conservative voices on that show on ABC, along with Meghan McCain. Abby Huntsman is leaving The View to spend more time with her family and to help in her father's campaign for governor of Utah. John Huntsman, he had been governor of Utah before. He served as our ambassador to Russia under President Trump. He served as our ambassador to China under President Obama. John Huntsman, I think if he is reelected governor of Utah, is somebody with presidential ambitions. He ran before. In any event, it is wild, wild to believe that that all of this is Trump's doing. The point I was making about The View was Joy Behar on The View got applause by saying that America's most prominent Nazi, whose name is Richard Spencer, had condemned Trump for killing Soleimani. Yeah, that's right. Why? Well, because Soleimani is a dedicated to Israel's extermination, and Nazis kind of like that. One other thing that I don't think you can blame Trump for is, look, we have a lot of debate in the United States right now about an obesity crisis. The one of the very few indications where health is deteriorating in America is a larger number of Americans who are obese. There is a new book by Jay Richards, who's wonderful and is a great friend of the show, which actually says that the way to deal with that crisis, with health, with food, is by going back to some basic religious principles from 2,000 years ago. We'll talk about that and more coming up on The MedVed Show. On The Michael Medved Show, one of the big trends that people are predicting for 2020 has been kicked off in an example of perfect timing by the release of an important new book by Jay Richards. And Jay is a friend. He is a senior fellow at Discovery Institute. Dr. Richards is also an assistant professor in the Bush School of Business at the Catholic University of America and executive editor of The Stream. His new book is called Eat, Fast, Feast, and Heal Your Body While Feeding Your Soul. It is a Christian guide to fasting. Jay, this is a real change of subject for you.
It is. I mean, in many ways, it sort of brings together my avocational interests. I've been a kind of a fitness buff, as you know, for a long time. I was a strength trainer in college. I've always been interested in nutrition and things like that, and have struggled with fasting as a Christian, to be honest, for years. I would try it periodically and fail, and really kind of stumbled upon the wonders of fasting because I had weirdly, I'd like to say it was my spiritual death, but it was actually a medical procedure I had that forced me not to eat for 36 hours. And I had been eating kind of low carb and thought, oh, this is going to be terrible. And I had this weird lucidity in which my mind was clear and I felt strong and energetic and thought, this is really weird, and started researching it. And lo and behold, discovered there's actually growing scientific evidence that fasting is actually good for you physically. And so that led me on this journey in which I realized, okay, for Christians, this has been a long tradition, at least certainly for Catholics. For 1,500 years, fasting was as much a part of the Christian life as praying and worshiping. And every major religion, as you know, has some kind of fasting regime. And so I realized, gosh, this is a longstanding religious tradition. For most Christians, it's completely dropped off the radar screen. And now people starting in places like California are discovering the physical benefits of fasting. And so I wanted to bring those two things together.
Okay. What traditionally, when you say this was part of Christian tradition, in Judaism, we have six fasts a year. And two of them are full 25-hour fasts, and then four of them are sun up to sundown fasts. But they're also fasts that include no drinking, no water of any kind. The Christian fast that you're writing about, would they also exclude water?
Almost never. So that's the one thing. So they're dry fasts. Jews have dry fasts, as you mentioned, and then Muslims during the month of Ramadan, it's a full fast, so no liquid or food, not even any water from sunrise to sunset for a full month. Christians, it's always been primarily food. And so for the first few centuries, at least, we know from about the second century AD, Christians were regularly fasting all day on Wednesdays and Fridays and then having kind of a mini feast on Sundays. And then within about 400 or 500 years after Christ, Christians added what we now think of as Lent, this roughly 40-day season prior to the great feast of Easter, and then also Advent, which Christians mostly don't realize now is actually a time of fasting, several weeks leading up to Christmas. And they, you know, those varied. So the Wednesdays and Fridays were just basically an all-day fast, like you said, 26 hours or so, and maybe even 36 if you miss two nights in a row. And then those Lenten and Advent fasts, they varied. The closest you can get to seeing what it was like historically is to look at what the Eastern Orthodox and Eastern Rite Christians do, in which they're essentially eating a vegan diet during the week for 46 days during Lent, which is pretty robust for most Western Christians.
Okay, so what was why Wednesday, by the way? Friday, obviously, is the day of the crucifixion, so you can understand why people would be fasting. Why would ancient Christians fast on Wednesdays?
So Wednesday was the day that traditionally Jesus was betrayed by Judas, and then, of course, Friday was Good Friday. And so it represented those two things. And at the time, both the Jews and Romans, it turns out, also fasted early on 2 days a week in different days. And so even the pagan Romans, you read the church fathers and say, look, the pagans, they fast 2 days a week. I forget, it was like Tuesday and Thursday. We should do it on Wednesday and Friday because the Lord was betrayed and crucified on those days. And so they didn't think, well, the pagan Romans are fasting, we shouldn't do it. It was just sort of common sense that you should fast. And in fact, that's what Jesus says. Jesus doesn't command his followers to fast. He assumes they'll fast. He says, when you fast, when you pray, when you give alms, do it in such a way that you're not being ostentatious. And so my view as a Christian is, well, Jesus assumed we were going to fast. If he fasted in the desert for 40 days before he started his earthly ministry, and of all the Christians closest to that time all thought fasting was an important thing, then why do we think that we're better and smarter and should completely drop it?
Okay, first of all, before we get to the spiritual benefits of fasting, what about the physical benefits of fasting? Because this is very eye-opening in your book. The book is called Eat, Fast, Feast, and it's one of those instant bestsellers, Heal Your Body While Feeding Your Soul. What's the physiological advantage of fasting?
Well, it's actually several different things. The obvious thing, the thing that's sort of most intuitive, is that doctors are discovering that they can reverse obesity and type 2 diabetes with fasting. And essentially, if you think about your body, the way we eat, the sort of standard American diet, we're constantly perturbing our insulin. So we're constantly eating a lot of sugar, a lot of very simplified and processed carbohydrates, and that keeps our insulin dial turned up quickly. Insulin is basically a substance in your body. You can think of it as a signaling hormone that tells your liver and your cells to absorb the sugar that's in your bloodstream. And if you're eating constantly, you're eating a high sugar diet, you're constantly doing that. And as a result, our insulin levels stay high. And so what happens is we actually start storing that extra sugar as fat. Fat around our bodies is actually food energy that we're storing for a rainy day or for a famine or a time when we don't have any food. But most of us aren't like that anymore. We have food constantly. What fasting does, that basically reverses that process. And so if you go a long period without fasting, or you eat ketogenically, which means just a diet in which you really don't have any carbohydrates, your body will deplete its carbohydrates, and then it starts using fat for fuel, and it turns either your dietary fat or your body fat into something called ketones, which is a completely different form of energy that your body can use. I'm convinced that for most of human history, this is how God designed us, is to be flexible so that we could either use the carbohydrates and sugar, or we could use fats and ketones. And when things are working right, we're doing both of those things. But the modern diet prevents us from using one of those systems. It basically says we've got a hybrid system like a Toyota Prius, but we're only using the battery. We're never using a gas tank. Fasting essentially mimics this kind of older way of eating in which we're feasting some of the time. We're eating a lot. We're eating modestly most of the time. And then sometimes we're going without food. And that keeps us metabolically flexible. It keeps our bodies using fat, it keeps our insulin levels low, and it keeps us honestly from being obese. So that's
okay. Do you recommend going back to a practice of fasting 2 days a week, or 25-hour fasts, or just 12-hour fasts?
I do. I actually think there are different benefits at different levels, but I think for really getting your insulin levels low and steady, it's a good idea for healthy people that aren't obviously underweight. Two days a week fasting, I think, is a really good thing. In fact, people that are overweight, I think a 2 36-hour fast, which is, it's essentially you go from, let's say, Monday night, to Wednesday morning, essentially. There are lots of reasons to think that's actually really good. It also does other things. It actually kicks your cells into what's called autophagy, which is basically a state in which your body or your cells are recycling broken parts, essentially. And your cells are in sort of one of two states. They're either doing that, they're either in the go-go mode in which they're using energy and they're doing the things that you need to get through the day, or they're in recycle mode. And if we're constantly eating, it's like we're driving our car 70 miles an hour all the time. We're never taking it in to get the oil change. Fasting actually sends a signal to our cells to kick into autophagy, kick into this recycle mode. But it takes a little bit of while for that.
Okay, all of this challenging and fascinating. It is, there's a foreword by Jason Fung, who is author of The Obesity Code. Dr. Jason Fung, the book Eat, Fast, Feast. It's posted at our website at michaelmedved.com. The author, J. Richards, senior fellow at Discovery Institute. We will be right back. On the Michael Medved Show, I, of course, have been aware my whole life of most of the fasting in the Jewish tradition, some of the minor, what are called minor fasts, which are half-day fasts, I've only picked up as an adult. But every Jewish kid knows about Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, which is 25 hours of no food, no water. I think many people know all about Ramadan, which is a whole month. It's sacred to Muslims, where they fast during the day. and then celebrate, have an iftar meal, have celebrate in the evening. What Jay Richards does in his new book, Eat, Fast, Feast, is bring back the Christian aspects of this very common human tradition. And Jay, I wanted to continue the conversation because we really didn't get a chance. You were saying that fasting on a regular basis not only has profound physiological benefits, but also provides all kinds of spiritual benefits as well. Why?
Well, this is, I would argue theologically, that God didn't just make us sort of ghosts in bodies. We're not just souls trapped in bodies like Plato had it. We're also not just, you know, sort of glorified monkeys descended from the trees. We are this unity of the breath of God and the dust of the earth, of body and soul. And so we should expect that there's going to be some kind of integration of these things. We often, when we think the spiritual life, well, that's just a sort of a purely spiritual kind of ghostly thing that we do inside our heads. But no, we're bodies. God made us as bodies. And so what if you read any Christian church father, they will tell you, I mean, they're unanimous on this, that fasting, it's not just something you do to discipline your body. You do it to discipline your soul. It improves your prayer life. It even somehow has benefits with respect to spiritual warfare. There's this famous passage in the Gospels in which some disciples are trying to exorcise demons and they can't do it. And they go to Jesus and Jesus says, this kind can only come out by prayer and fasting. So fasting, if we're to believe that, actually it somehow gives greater strength to our capacities as praying and fighting the principalities and powers of this world. That's a very unusual thing, but I honestly think it's how God made us. He made us body and soul, and so it makes sense that we would have spiritual disciplines that also involve our body.
Is there a possibility, because again, you there's so much attention right now, there is a an American who actually was hunger striking. He was being held in prison on charges he believed were false in Egypt. And I believe he just died because of his hunger striking. Is there a danger that people take the fasting too far and that it carry over into what people call eating disorders?
That's, I think, the kind of key question. So I always tell people, look, if you actually have an eating disorder, if you just have issues with food, you ought to be under a doctor's care. Though I also think, on the other hand, that part of the problem we have in the 21st century with food, the fact that diabetes is rampant, type 2 diabetes and obesity, and to some degree even eating disorders, may be the result of this lack of balance with food. For hundreds of years, in Western tradition, and in fact in every major religion, they had these fasting regimes, not just as private spiritual practices, but as corporate acts. And so I don't think it's a coincidence that just as those things disappear in our culture, we end up with food problems that were mostly unheard of before. But certainly if you have a problem eating food, someone say that has anorexia nervosa or bulimia, then it would be a real danger for you personally, I think.
How long have you been fasting regularly?
I've been fasting regularly now for a few years. And so I advise people that are going to fast not to jump right in. I mean, it's like trying to swim the English Channel. You don't want to do that. So in the book, I actually lay out a plan to ease people into fasting, because even though it's a sacrifice and it's difficult, it shouldn't be torture. And if a person has never fasted, if they decide, I'm going to do a 72-hour water-only fast, I mean, you could do it. If someone locked you up in a cage, you would survive, but it would be very, very unpleasant. It's different, though, if you say start out eating ketogenically or quit eating carbohydrates for a few days, your body's in this state of ketosis where it's burning fat, and then you start limiting the amount of time you eat during the day. So you eat all your food within 8 hours, and then after a week or two, narrow it to 4 hours, and then to 1 hour. Within a few weeks, you will discover things that you thought would have been impossible a few weeks before actually are not only not difficult, they're sometimes actually pleasant.
Okay, you have three words in the title of your book. It's Eat, Fast, and Feast. We haven't spoken yet at all about the feasting component. Maybe we can leave people with that.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't spend as much time talking about feasts just because we have retained those. And so everyone, even the most secular American, if he has any kind of connection to Christianity, will celebrate Christmas. We have national feasts like Thanksgiving. Christians all still celebrate Easter, but we have dropped the fasting seasons that precede that. And I think that what that actually does is it causes us to lose the meaning of a feast, because a feast traditionally was something that you did as a celebration of something that came before. And so there should always be a preparatory time leading up to that. And I can tell you, if you've really been fasting seriously for 40 odd days during Lent, and you feel like you just really haven't eaten, when you get to that Easter season, you really feel it. I mean, you feel it physically, you feel it spiritually, you just notice something that you didn't before. And so I argue that God doesn't want us just to fast all the time. Sometimes we're supposed to feast and to celebrate, but he doesn't always want us to do that. A feast is supposed to be a celebration and not overeating. And so my argument is that essentially if we can recover traditional fasting, will actually enjoy and benefit more from the feast as well.
You know, there's a big example of that in Jewish tradition, which you may not know about, but it fits in very much with part of what you're talking about in your book, Eat, Fast, Feast, is that for a bride and groom, one hopes that the very, very happiest day of your whole life, and that's certainly true for me coming up to my anniversary, was the day that Diane and I got married. But when you get married, when you're a bride and groom, you fast the day of so that the first breaking of the fast is the glass of wine, the sip of wine that you share under the wedding canopy. And that becomes then a very, very meaningful prelude to a big wedding feast. And the idea being that it focuses the mind on the spiritual aspect of what you're about to do and not just the physical.
Exactly right. That's perfect. That's a perfect distillation of the way I think God intends us to live our lives.
Yeah. And again, the same thing takes place at our most festive holiday, the holiday of Purim, which is preceded because in the book of Esther, when Esther is getting ready to meet with the king and to save the Jewish people, she fasts and prays. Mm-hmm. And so we have Tanit Esther. We have the fast of Esther right before the celebration of Purim. And and then you can really cut loose. And that's certainly a holiday where there is an abundant amount of drinking, celebration, and food. What next? Are you speaking to various church groups and others about Eat, Fast, Feast?
I am. And in fact, I was talking about this for a couple of years. I would talk about it during Lent and write about it. And the book came out because, honestly, I had so many people tell me, look, you should really write a book about this and tie all this together. Because most people, they may have heard something about the tech bros in California doing these intermittent fasting or traditional Catholics, they have some vague sense that people used to do that. But most religious people had not thought about this as both a physical and a spiritual practice.
Well, the book will help them with those thoughts and with that information and with that background and some of the arguments. Jay Richards is known for many important books. One of my favorites, Money, Greed, and God. That came out about a decade ago. Now it's Eat, Fast, Feast. And thank you for your contribution to some of the most elemental questions facing everyone in this greatest nation on God's green earth.